Daniel chapter 1 kind of sets the stage of this book. It tells us why it is Daniel is up in the idolatry capital of the universe, Babylon, why he's up there. He's up there because of judgment on the nation Israel that God has brought about. This judgment took place about 600 years before Christ, and it is the completion of the kingdom era in Israel. Remember, it divided following Solomon's death back here into a northern kingdom consisting of 10 nations and a southern nation kingdom consisting of 2. Judah and Benjamin down here and all the rest of them up here. Well, the northern kingdom was carried off into captivity in about 722 BC by the Assyrians in judgment against them by God. And the southern kingdom lasted a little longer. It went down to about 605 BC. This is the end of a 20-year siege of Jerusalem here, 586. It really started in 606. So in 606, Nebuchadnezzar comes down here and he sieges what's left of the kingdom in Israel, the southern two tribes, and carries them off to Babylon. Daniel is part of that getting carried off to Babylon. So for the 70-year interval from roughly 606 BC, for the next 70 years, the events in the book of Daniel take place. So that's where they are on the timeline, okay? The conclusion of the kingdom in Israel is what has prompted Daniel to be taken from Jerusalem up to Babylon, and he's been brought into the court of Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, through a particular education opportunity that he and some other of the Jewish youngsters, late teenagers, that kind of thing, had the opportunity to go through, and he did, and so he's up there now, completed that program, and he's in the service of Nebuchadnezzar. Also, as part of his preparation, is the fact that he can interpret dreams. Not everybody can do this, but God enabled him to do that. Daniel understood all kinds of visions and dreams. That was part of his divine preparation for this job that he now has up there in Babylon. The reason for that preparation is that God is going to reveal to mankind through Nebuchadnezzar a broad sweeping panorama of prophetic history. And Daniel is going to interpret that dream that Nebuchadnezzar has. So Daniel's been put in place in Babylon at Nebuchadnezzar's arm's length to be used by God to interpret this dream that Nebuchadnezzar is going to have. All right, that's why he's there and what's going to go on here. Well, we saw the first of 6 visions that take place in this book last week. And the primary focus of that first vision was what? What was the object of that, remember? Here's just what it looked like. It was a pretty goofy-looking statue, but that's what it was. It was a statue. The significance of that particular statue is that it was segmented into 4 different segments, each of which was represented by a metal. And as you went from the head to the foot, the metal decreased in value. There was something about whatever it represented that got a little worse as time went on. So that statue that Nebuchadnezzar saw in his dream was a 4-segmented statue. And each of those segments represented, we think, a world power that was going to take place from the time of Nebuchadnezzar and Daniel, about 600 BC, all the way down to the Second Advent. Because it was said that it pertained to what's called the latter days. Okay? The latter days is that time frame from roughly Daniel's day, 600 BC, down to Messiah. That's the latter days. It's also called the times of the Gentiles because all of these different segments here, these world empires represented by these different segments, are Gentile world powers. And they would all dominate and subjugate the nation Israel. So in Daniel chapter 2, the big broad brush panorama of a biblical history tells us that from Daniel's day down to when Messiah returns, there will be 4 world empires that are Gentile world empires that will dominate and subjugate the nation Israel. The 4th one of these is the most interesting of them in that it consists not only of the legs of iron, which can pound any one of those metals above it into submission, but it also has 10 toes that are comprised of clay mixed with iron. Is clay any good for anything? Messes up your carpeting, doesn't it? That's about all it's good for. Clay won't stick to iron well. You can't smelt clay and iron together into anything. So that union, represented by the 10 toes in this figure, of 10 nations joining together in some capacity or another, that isn't going to be very strong. And what happened to those 10 toes on the bottom of that figure as part of that vision that Daniel had? Remember what happened? A stone cut without hands. It was not a man-made stone. This was a divinely made stone. Smashes this statue right here on the feet, and the whole thing crushes into dust. The whole figure that it's representing there just turns to dust and is blown away. In other words, it's destroyed by the stone. So it's a picture of God working through his son Christ, the stone, will, at the time that this 10-nation federation down here is in existence, he will come back and he will crush that, and all the previous world empires that are part of that are crushed along with him, along with that. Now, if I brought that map, which I don't know if I did or not. Yeah, here's the one I wanted to show you again. The geography involved here of that statue is this. Now, everything you see up there in some color other than this drab brown or whatever this is, all of this stuff inside this red line right here, that's the old Roman Empire. That's the geography of the old Roman Empire. And what this vision is telling us is that from that old Roman Empire, the legs of iron, will come a 10-nation conglomerate of some kind. That's the 10 toes. That's the clay. And it will come from those countries right there. Doesn't mean it will be every one of them, but from this geography will come some sort of 10-nation federation that will be, in essence, a revision, a reviving of the old Roman Empire, and it will be in existence at some point in time just before Messiah comes back, and he will come back and he will crush it. Now, what we know about this from other places in Scripture is that this 10-nation federation will be headed up by the Antichrist. He will come out of this European Union conglomerate, whatever the heck, and he will head that up. And so he will be running some sort of a kingdom here from these countries at the time that Messiah will come back. We'll see more of this as we go through all this, and we'll repeat this several times over. But the general gist of the vision in Daniel chapter 2 is that from Daniel's day on down to Messiah, four world empires, one of which sort of goes away and comes back, four world empires of Gentile peoples will dominate and subjugate the Jewish people during that time. So if you're reading Daniel's book and you're a Jew, you may want to ask yourself, what the heck is going to happen to me? What's God going to do to his family, his Jewish family, his chosen people? Are the promises of the Abrahamic covenant no longer valid? Are we going to lose our land, seed, and blessing? Is he going to let these Gentile peoples wipe us off the face of the earth? I mean, if you're understanding the vision in chapter 2, you got to wonder what's in store for you if you're a Jew. Because it looks like the Gentiles are going to just make mincemeat out of you whenever they want to. So, what will happen to the Jewish people in light of this vision in Daniel chapter 2? Well, that's why we have Daniel chapter 3. Daniel chapter 3 will give us that answer. What will happen to the Jewish people in light of this panorama of Gentile world domination from then until Messiah? So let's look at Daniel chapter 3 and let's get our answer. All right. Daniel chapter 3, verse 1. Nebuchadnezzar the king made an image of gold, the height of which was 60 cubits and its width 6 cubits. And he set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. So Nebuchadnezzar decides here he's going to make this It's like an obelisk type thing, kind of like the Washington Monument in terms of profile. It's tall and lean, okay? 90 feet tall and 9 feet wide. So it's just a big, long pipe sticking up out there in the desert. And he puts it in the desert so that it can be seen from miles and miles around. It is a tribute to himself. It is a image to Nebuchadnezzar and to his greatness. So he builds this thing. I guess it's gold-plated instead of solid gold. If it was solid gold, there'd be a lot of people over digging in the desert, wouldn't they? Trying to find this sucker. So I guess it's gold-plated. I don't know. 90 feet tall, 6 and 9 feet in diameter or square to base, whatever exact shape was. So then he sent word to assemble the satraps, the prefects, the governors, the counselors, treasurers, judges, magistrates, and all the rulers of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. This thing has both a political component to it, as you can see right here. He invites all of his political cronies to come and join the dedication ceremony for this thing. All levels of government and all that sort of stuff. Then they all come, verse 3, and they were assembled for the dedication of the image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. And they stood before that image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. So it has a political representation to it, like the Washington Monument would. I mean, it's kind of a political figure thingy. So that part of it is kind of represented by this. Then the herald loudly proclaimed to the command, he says, to you, the command is given, O peoples, nations, and men of every language, that's everybody in the Babylonian Empire, no matter who you were, what country you were from, that at the moment you hear the sound of the horn, flute, lyre, dragon, psalter, bagpipe, and all kinds of music, you are to fall down and worship the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. So when a certain blast of music was heard, everybody was to hit their knees and worship this thing. This thing had a religious component to it as well. It's not just political. It is political and religious. There is both a political leadership represented by this thing and a religious leadership represented by this thing. Is that ringing any bells? Coming out of the book of Revelation, maybe? Is that ringing any Revelation chapter 13 bells? What happened there? The second beast came up out of the ground that was seen there in Revelation chapter 13, and he made, the second beast, made this image of the first beast, the political leader, and he compelled the people to worship that image, didn't he? Exact same thing takes place in Revelation chapter 13 during the tribulation period as what took place right here with Nebuchadnezzar. Revelation 13 and what's going on right here in Daniel chapter 3 are parallel to one another. So to the Jewish reader who during the tribulation period might need to turn to Revelation 13 to see what happened there or sees what happened here to try to apply it to there, these two chapters are parallel. They're important. There's lessons for the Jew in Daniel chapter 3 that they may have to apply later on during the tribulation period when the events of Revelation chapter 13 take place. Did you follow that? Did you follow what I just said there? Okay. So, the rules of this statue are you got to fall down and worship it whenever this sound goes off. And he is a master of negative motivation. He says in verse 6, whoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately be cast into the midst of a furnace of blazing fire. He's just going to cook you right on down if you don't hit your knees when that sound goes off. So you're going to worship Nebuchadnezzar's symbol of his empire, both political and religious, or you're going to get fried. Therefore, at that time, when all the peoples heard the sound of the horn, flute, lyre, trumpet, psalter, bagpipe, and all kinds of music, all the peoples, nations, and men of every language fell down and worshipped the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. Well, I guess so. Why wouldn't you? Why wouldn't you hit your knees to keep from getting cooked by Nebuchadnezzar? Well, not everybody quite saw it just like I just summarized. For this reason, at that time, certain Chaldeans came forward and brought charges against the Jews. There have been deep states around for a long time, haven't there? There are politicians in Babylon at this time who don't like the fact that the Jews, we know at least four, have been promoted to significant positions of government there. They don't like them. The Chaldeans don't like the Jewish party. And so here's an opportunity to dump on them. They brought charges against the Jews. And they responded and said to Nebuchadnezzar, the king, this is Nebuchadnezzar's grunts, O king, live forever. You yourself, O king, have made a decree that every man who hears the sound of all these musical instruments is to fall down and worship the golden image. This is your rule, Nebuchadnezzar. You set this up. But whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into the midst of a furnace of blazing fire. And lo and behold, there are certain Jews whom you have appointed, dear old king, over the administration in the province of Babylon, namely Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, have disregarded you, and they do not serve your gods or worship the golden image which you have set up. You see the plot here? It's quite simple. The Jewish party in Babylon's enemies see an opportunity to hurt them. So they remind Nebuchadnezzar that his own rule, which he set up himself, that you got to worship this thing when you hear the sound of this music, these guys ain't paying any attention to that. They're not doing that. They're not worshiping you or your image or anything about it. They're breaking your rules, Nebuchadnezzar. So then Nebuchadnezzar, verse 13, in rage and anger, is it ever smart to govern from a standpoint of rage and anger? That's not too smart, is it? As good a leader as this guy is, and he is a good leader, he wouldn't be the head of gold on that statue. As good as he is not without certain problems, and this is one of them. He lets his rage and his anger govern his thinking at times. So he spins up real tight here over this news, and he gave orders to king to bring in Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that these men were brought in before the king. Now remember, this is Daniel's three friends. We saw Daniel and these three guys go down there. They were all part of the same program, all part of being trained for government jobs and this sort of thing, and they're in those jobs and so on. So that's who we're talking about here. So he brings them in. Verse 14, he responded and said to them, is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the golden image that I have set up? Is this true, what I'm hearing from these other guys about you? That you're not worshiping me and my image here? Now, if you're ready, at the moment you hear the sound of the horn, flute, lyre, dragon, all that stuff, if you will fall down and worship that image that I have made, very well. But if you will not, you will be immediately cast into the midst of a furnace of blazing fire. And what God is there who can deliver you out of my hands? So he gives them a second chance, but he makes one real bad mistake here. He compares himself to God. He said, who can stop me from doing what I want to do? Who the flip do you think you're serving and worshiping? I am the king of this empire. There is no God that can stop me. I'm sovereign here. And he might have gotten away with something, but that's a mistake that he should not have made. Challenging the creator God of this universe in a comparison to himself was not smart. Who can deliver out of my hands? Well, he's going to find out. So Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we don't need to give you an answer concerning this. Wow. That's kind of the basic back of your hand up the side of his face, isn't it? We don't have to give you an answer here, Hoss. We don't care that you're the king of Babylon. We don't have to answer you. Yeah, Cheryl.
Well, when it says, then what God will be able to rescue, is he just talking about idols and, you know, what God?
Well, I think what he's basically saying to them is that he thinks he's sovereign over them, and that they need to be worshiping him and his symbol there, whatever that thing is. And their response is, no, we don't. We don't have to worship you and your symbol. Now, wouldn't it have been a lot easier for those three guys to just simply, when they hear that sound, you know, take five, just hit the ground, you know, take a blow. Who cares if you aren't really worshiping the thing or not? You can just sort of act like it and go along to get along type thing. Wouldn't that have been pretty easy for them? Wouldn't that have been what about 99 out of 100 people would do? Just go along to get along? Whatever the corporate rules are, I don't care if they're immoral and dishonest and unjust, and we'll go along to keep our jobs and so on and so forth. But these three guys take a different stand. He says, if it be so, verse 17, they said, our God whom we serve, he is able to deliver us from the furnace of blazing fire. They answer his question in verse 15, who can deliver out of my hands? They say, our God can deliver us out of your hands. That's who. There's your answer you're looking for. He's able to do that. And if he so chooses, he will do that, verse 17. So they don't just go along to get along. They basically say, we're not going to worship you or your statue, your symbol, whatever it is. We're going to worship our God. And we know that he is able to deliver us from your hand. You asked the question, we gave you the answer. Does that mean they know for sure God's going to deliver them out of that? No, look at their next comment. They say, but even if he does not. Now, there's no doubt in their mind what God can do. And we should always be that way too, shouldn't we? We shouldn't have any concerns about what God can do. But what will God do? He doesn't always tell us what he will do ahead of time, does he? We may have an idea, maybe there's a principle here or there we can apply, but we don't always know for sure. So they say, look, we know what he can do. If he so chooses to deliver us out of your hands, that's what he will do. But if he does not, even if he chooses not to, let it be known to you, O king, we're not going to serve your gods or worship the golden image if you have set up. So their choice is, even if God does not deliver them, they're still going to obey him. So they know that deliverance is possible and martyrdom is possible, just as possible, both of them. They don't know which. They're equally possible. God could deliver them, and he might not. But they don't care. They're going to obey God either way. So they tell Nebuchadnezzar, sorry, pal, we are not going to worship your image. That's a life and death decision they just made, isn't it? And they don't know yet which it'll be. Will it be life? Will God deliver them? Or will it be death? Will Nebuchadnezzar kill them? But either way, they have made up their minds that they are going to obey God, not worship this idol thingy, whatever it is, and that's their choice. So here he goes again. If he wasn't mad before, he's definitely mad now. He was filled with wrath, and his facial expression was altered toward these three guys. Well, that smile he had on his face disappeared in a hurry. And he answered by giving orders to heat the furnace 7 times more than it was usually heated. Now that is really smart, isn't it? Are these guys going to be like 7 times as dead as they were before? I mean, see what happens when you govern from wrath or rage. It's just ridiculous. You become foolish. There's no reason to do this. If they're going to burn to death, they're going to burn to death. You don't have to make the fire 7 times hotter. That just creates a problem for yourself. So anger and wrath can produce foolish behavior and usually does. So he commanded certain valiant warriors who were in his army to tie up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in order to cast them into the furnace of blazing fire. I mean, he uses his best warriors. That's even more foolish. Why do you need to risk injury, danger, whatever, to your best warriors over something that is already going to produce the end result, that is their death? Foolishness on his part. So he gets his best, most brutal Rambo types to tie up these guys. You know, you got Mr. Rogers here being tied up by Rambo to make sure they don't get away. And they tied them up in their clothing. They had on their trousers, their coats, their caps, and their other clothes, and they were cast into the midst of the furnace of blazing fire. So they tie these guys up and throw them in. For this reason, because the king's command was urgent and the furnace had been made extremely hot, the flame of the fire slew those men who carried up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Is that thing alive? Or did that come from next door? Next door? All right. Well, we can't turn theirs off necessarily. Beg pardon?
You've added a soundtrack to your sermon.
Yeah. Get a little background music to the narrative here, huh? All right. So you see what's happened here? I don't know how this furnace is constructed, but apparently in getting close enough to it to chuck these guys in it, they get too close to the flames and the fire and they get killed. He loses these valiant warriors that he has in throwing these men into the fire. So these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell into the midst of the furnace of blazing fire, still tied up. So, in they go. A furnace that's 7 times hotter than normal. I used to work for Alcoa one summer when I was grunting my way through college, and this one particular mill I worked at, they would draw off this vat of molten aluminum, and it was so hot, they carried it by train car 50 miles up the road to another city where it was used to cast car bumpers, back when cars actually had metal bumpers. It shows you how far back that was. And it was so hot, it stayed molten, you know, for the next day or two, something like that. It was just extraordinarily hot. Molten aluminum, as you can imagine, is very, very hot. So they just truck it off up there and use it over the next day or two. This was probably something like that. This thing was just so hot. And by the way, you didn't want any of that spill on you. That would hurt. So they got this thing so hot that the guys getting close to it got burned up. So they're down in there, and one would have figured, of course, by this point in time, they'd been consumed by the flames. But verse 24, Nebuchadnezzar the king was astounded and stood up in haste. Apparently he can see somehow or another into this furnace. I don't know, had a little audience chair built up there of some kind. He's watching what's going on. He looks and he sees something that astounds him. He pops up and responded and said to high officials, "Was it not 3 men that we cast into the midst of fire?" I said, "Yeah." "Yeah, we counted them. We know it was just 3. And he said in verse 25, "Well, look, I see 4 men loosed and walking about in the midst of the fire without harm. And the appearance of the fourth is like a son of the gods." So Nebuchadnezzar looks in the furnace and he sees not the 3 guys that were put in. He sees 4 guys strolling around in there. They're hands and feet or whatever that were tied up are now loosed so they can walk around inside the furnace. And there's a fourth individual in there. There's a fourth guy in the fire. If you're the nation Israel, and you're being represented in this incident by Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, which they were, what kind of encouragement would it be to you to see that fourth guy walking around in there, and they're up walking around unhurt? What would you conclude from this incident if you were a Jew reading this story? Gentile domination. Four world empires dominating the Jews from Daniel's day down to Messiah, and you're worried about, are you going to be wiped out and destroyed by them, and you saw this storyline right here, what would you conclude? That maybe God is going to protect you? That God is going to take care of his people? That the fourth guy in the furnace is the superintending God of this universe, watching over his chosen people? And he has protected them from whatever the possible harm may be there. This whole lesson, I think, is designed to be an encouragement to the Jews. When things start to really happen to them during the tribulation period, when the Antichrist turns on them in the middle of the tribulation period, when that battle in heaven takes place and all those demons are thrown out and they come down here to the earth so that all of that evil is housed down here on the planet and is directed against Israel, they're going to think they're in that furnace. And ain't going to be far from it. What's going to happen to them is pretty close to it. But the encouraging part of this story for them is that God will protect them and care for them even then too. He's not going to let them get wiped out as a nation. There will be a believing remnant that he will protect and save at all times, even if the circumstances of that nation are like this circumstance, when they think they're in some kind of a fiery furnace, the fourth man in the furnace will protect them. And that's God. So their lesson here in this chapter, I think, is to answer the question we posed earlier at the end of chapter 2 about, well, what's going to happen to Israel? They're going to be taken care of. They're going to be protected by God. Well, what about us? This is a good story for the Jews, but how about us Gentile types? Anything in this for us, I wonder? Does this illustrate any New Testament doctrine or principle that we see from time to time? Remember my harp on you is that the Old Testament illustrates all of our New Testament doctrines? Can you think of any New Testament doctrines that this might illustrate? Consider a few verses here. James 1, 2, and 3. Consider it all joy, my brethren, when you encounter various trials, written to believers. Happen to be Jewish believers here, but doesn't matter. Trials, various trials. We are going to encounter them. They are inevitable. We're going to end up in this furnace from time to time. Now, maybe it isn't heated seven times more. Maybe it's just a regular furnace. That's okay. We will be in trials from time to time. They're inescapable as believers. Peter says the same thing in 1 Peter 1, 6 through 9. In this you greatly rejoice, even though now for a little while, if necessary, you have been distressed by various trials. You have fallen into various furnaces, so that the proof of your faith, being more precious than gold, which is perishable, even though tested by fire, may be found to result in praise and glory and honor at the revelation of Jesus Christ. And though you've not seen him and you love him, and though you do not see him now, you believe in him, you greatly rejoice with joy inexpressible and full of glory, obtaining as the outcome of your faith the salvation of your souls. Trials are common to the Christian life. Fiery furnaces are going to overtake us from time to time in the Christian life. And it can be in a great variety of forms. Physical, mental, emotional, financial, I mean, you name it. All kinds of fiery furnaces out there. So how does the fourth man in the fire here help us? 1 Corinthians 10:13. No temptation or test, no fiery furnace has overtaken you, but such as is common to man. Your fiery furnaces ain't any different than mine and everybody else's. We all go through the same sort of stuff. they're commonplace for us believers to go through. But God is faithful, and he will not allow you to be tested beyond what you are able, but will, with the temptation, provide the way of escape so that you will be able to endure it. So no matter what your fiery furnace may be, you can survive the experience. He'll provide some way there for you. How does he do that? How does he know how to do all of that? I don't know. Maybe it's because he's God. 2 Peter 2:9, then the Lord knows how to rescue the godly from testing and to keep the unrighteous under punishment for the day of judgment. He just knows how. He's good at that. He can deliver us from those fiery furnaces some way, somehow. He won't test us beyond what we can endure, and he will provide a way that we can endure it. So Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they got just kind of a first-grade miracle, didn't they? They got the Lord down there joining them, walking around with them. We ain't going to get that. Not quite that obvious. We'll get something, but not quite that obvious. We'll get some sort of divine deliverance, some sort of divine help. Maybe it comes through some friends and somebody like that. Maybe it comes through some sort of medical care and treatment that we need. Maybe it comes through some financial aid of some sort. I don't know what it'll be. But God knows how to bring about help to us when we're in those fiery furnaces. So their experience is illustrative of our experiences as New Testament church age saints. They just got a full-blown miracle that we get something kind of a little different than that. So, same lesson for them is a lesson for us during the church age, but the application is a little different for them than maybe for us. Theirs will apply more eschatologically to the Messianic kingdom. Ours kind of applies to living the Christian life, our daily sanctification, that sort of thing. So, verse 26, going on with the story, Nebuchadnezzar came near to the door of the furnace of blazing fire, and he responded and said, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, come out, you servants of the Most High God, and come here. So they did. Now, he knows who they are serving. He knows it ain't him, and he knows it's their God. They've said that to him before, and now he's starting to recognize something. So he calls them out, recognizing that they serve a different God than he does. And all these political leaders in verse 27 gathered around and saw the same thing, that the fire had no effect on the bodies of these men, nor was the hair of their head singed, nor were their trousers damaged, nor had the smell of fire even come upon them. I mean, it was such a delivering miracle, they didn't even get the smoke stench in their clothing. Nothing, no effect whatsoever of this fire. So Nebuchadnezzar responded and said, well, blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and delivered his servants who put their trust in him. He understands what just happened. This guy's no dummy. He sees that they trusted their God and nothing happened to them in spite of what he was trying to accomplish. They violated the king's command and yielded up their bodies so as not to serve or worship any god except their own God. I understand that, he says. Therefore, I make a decree that any people, nation, or tongue that speaks anything offensive against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be torn limb from limb and their houses reduced to a rubbish heap, inasmuch as there is no other God who is able to deliver in this way. So he goes from trying to destroy anybody who would not worship him to making this decree that says, if you even speak against these guys as God, I'll chop you up in little pieces and make your house a rubbish heap. Some good negative motivation there again. And he calls them to prosper in the province of Babylon. It is a well-known Bible story, one of the best-known ones around. And it will be, I think, a particular significance to the Jews living during the tribulation period when they find themselves in that fiery furnace. When this kingdom turns on them, when this 10-nation federation that will exist during the tribulation period turns on them and tries to destroy them as a people, which it will, at the midpoint of it, The abomination of desolation, when you see that, that's the Antichrist. The Lord said, when you see that, you guys better hit the road out of Jerusalem as fast as you can. Don't go back for a coat. You better hope you're not pregnant or anything that would slow you down, because you need to get out of there, because he's going to turn on you so hard and so fast that if you can't get out of there, you're toast. So that empire, the 10 toes of the vision in chapter 2, will turn on the Jews just like this fiery furnace. And so the lesson will be particularly helpful to them at that time. And it's helpful to us in principle, illustrating a principle that we live under even today, but I think it's primarily intended for them. So any questions about chapter 3 before we mosey on any at all? Kind of see the purpose of chapter 3? The purpose of chapter 3 is to comfort the Jews in regards to the message of chapter 2. The message of chapter 2 says, man, it looks like we're going to get plowed under here. But the message of chapter 3 says, no, God will not allow his believing remnant to be destroyed by anybody and will protect them. He's the fourth man in the furnace for the Jews, and he's the fourth man in the furnace for us church age saints as well. Our furnace is a hospital bed or something like that. He will be there to help and protect us as well. Any questions about 3 before we amble on? Okay. Well, we need another good vision here, don't we? We haven't had a good vision in like one chapter, so we need another good vision. And that's what we get here in chapter 3. We get the second of 6 visions. The first one focused on a statue. They gave us this broad brush eschatological history from Daniel's day down to Messiah. That's chapter 2. This one in chapter 4, the second of 6 visions, focuses upon a tree. Okay? Statue in 2, a tree will be the focal point of this vision in chapter 4. And God will reveal some things that are also needful for the Jewish mind and thinking as they read through this book that he teaches here in chapter 4. All right. We ain't going to get through this sucker, are we? Well, yeah, go ahead, Jack.
Back, and this is just in my version, sometimes God is little g, sometimes God is big G.
Yeah.
Shadrach, Meshach, they're talking, it's always a capital. So I don't know if there's anything in the language, the Hebrew, the Arabic.
Absolutely, yes.
That has kind of different significance.
Yeah, it does. The translators are saying that the big G is talking about God. The little g is some other God, a man-made God, an idol or something like that. Not the God and creator of this universe as we know him. It's not Yahweh or any of the terms that are used of God. So when you see the big G, the original languages have something in there that identifies him as our creator and savior. The little g is just somebody's idol or something like that.
Sometimes Nebuchadnezzar's God is the big G, and sometimes it's the small g.
Well, now that's an interesting point you bring up there. Maybe we'll talk about that for a little bit and save that other vision. One of the questions that always comes out of this study is, well, does Nebuchadnezzar come to a point of belief in his actions here? Because he seems to be inching toward that as we read through here. At first, he kind of thinks God is nothing compared to him. But by the time we're done, he's giving pretty good homage to God. So the question always comes, well, did he come around in his interaction with God and believe? Or no? And we won't ever get the answer just black and white for sure, but I think there's a pretty good chance he did. I'm not going to be shocked if I see this guy in heaven. I ain't going to be shocked if I don't. But it looks to me like he, for a pagan, without any sort of a Jewish heritage or background, it looks like he might come around. God refers to him as his servant. But that doesn't necessarily mean that he can't use a non-believer as well. But it's a good sign. It's a positive mark on that side of the ledger there. So I don't know. I think maybe he actually comes around and we might see him someday. He clearly is the best leader of these world empires because he's the head of gold. He's represented by the best, most expensive metal in the statue. So there's something about his leadership and governance that God says is better than the Medo-Persians and the Greeks and the Romans and the revived Romans. So we won't ever get the answer, but I think there's a fair chance that the answer is positive, and I'm kind of optimistic on his behalf that maybe we'll see him someday.
Wasn't Nebuchadnezzar the one that kind of lost his mind, or, you know, he was out in the field eating grass?
Well, let's see chapter 4 and we'll see who he is. All right? Yeah, he ain't through learning yet. He's got some more lessons to go through.
And since he was restored, though, that tells me that God did bring him back.
Probably another check mark over on the positive side, too, isn't it? That restoration there. Because it'd been real easy to just blow this guy away. He ruled for like 42, 45 years, something like that. Quite a lengthy period of time that he ruled there in Babylon. But we'll see that experience in chapter 4. Very important lesson that relates to this overall theme of protecting the Jews during the fiery furnace trials that they're going to go through. And they haven't been through anything yet that's going to compare to what they're going to go through during the tribulation period. Only a third of them are even going to survive. Two-thirds of the Jews are going to be wiped out during the tribulation period. There ain't that many of them to begin with. Only like 12 million of them on the planet.
You know, today, in the first service, we heard about Barnabas.
Barnabas.
And Saul. And, you know, God used Saul, who was, you know, such a strong Jewish who was persecuting Christians, mm-hmm. to bring the message to the Gentiles.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, God can use kings angry and fear, you know. And
yeah.
And
well, you see right here.
Kings to yeah. do the same thing.
You can see in this storyline we're reading here that God took, he used a Gentile to convey this panorama of Jewish and world history. And one will say, well, why didn't he just use some good Jewish boy? His people, why didn't he do that? Well, because he chose to use Gentile. He chose to use Paul to minister to the Gentiles. Luke was probably a Gentile and was most helpful in varying in reading to and helping in writing to Jews. So he can use whoever he wants to do whatever he wants to do there and does. And some of Nebuchadnezzar's lessons yet to be learned are important for the Jews to be aware of. Because when the Antichrist turns on them during the tribulation period, it will be the harshest treatment by Gentiles that they will have experienced, certainly since the Holocaust and maybe including the Holocaust. The Holocaust wiped out, 6 million Jews? Half of them? Well, the Antichrist and the events of the tribulation period wipe out two-thirds of them. So they will go through some extremely difficult times. Their furnace is going to be heated 7 times over during the tribulation period. The Jews will be. So these lessons there in the book of Daniel will be very helpful to them at that time, hopefully. You got the 144,000 out there communicating the gospel of the kingdom about to take place, and maybe they will be instrumental in helping people to understand some of these principles and point out some of this stuff to them. I don't know for sure. Probably they will. So, good lessons for the Jews in Daniel, but some lessons for us as well. Any other questions or comments before we... Yeah.
Who do you think the figure in the fire was?
I beg your pardon?
Do you think the figure in the fire was...
Probably a pre-incarnate Christ appearing there with him. Nebuchadnezzar describes it as an angel, but he's just grasping at what he might have an idea of. That doesn't quite define everything just because he said that. I would think that would be the Lord in there walking around with him. They call that a theophany, an appearance of God. before the incarnation. Now, once he was incarnated, that had to stop, didn't it? Because he occupied humanity at that point in time. But before then, he could appear in a variety of places and times. And so they're probably stunned, to say the least, in trying to grasp the whole situation themselves, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Any other questions or comments? We'll save that next vision for next week then.